You know what we say here on the horn section.
Here's who.
This is a top to, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11,
oh,
11,
and most of
11,
and then amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is that any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on the Horn. It's Foxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Foxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Your host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
Hey, everybody, welcome aboard. Foxed Up here for it's Wednesday over here in Australia. It's probably just turning Wednesday where you are, Tuesday night, whatever it is. You know, it's that global thing that we do here. Welcome aboard Foxed Up here on the Head On Radio Network, and the only place where you're ever going to find the nonsense that you heard in the last hour. But boy, was that funny. I think there's a new parody coming, and I think it's going to be one of those timeless ones, Bob. You do one on the fundies, it's not like the Pastor from Montgomery thing. It's that one might last a while. But anyway, getting straight into business. last night's subject will be, well, tonight's subject, considering I kind of forgot about the arrangement with David, which was for last Thursday, which ended up being last night, so, anyway. we're going to get into the whole issue of the global oil quandary and food and fuel competing for one another. yes, Nanette, I bet you are probably right there. But anyway, but first, we have a track of the day to do, and I hope yesterday you enjoyed the music from two new friends of mine, and hopefully we'll become friends of the Head On Radio Network, Miss Heidi Limebeer and Rodney Alexander. And after having played Rodney's slapstick yesterday, I figured I should go back and for those of you that might not have been around during the old Fourth Estate Radio days, when Bruce and I would play a fair bit of Michael Hedges, who is most definitely a huge influence on Rodney Alexander and a huge influence on myself, was very possibly the most amazing acoustic guitarist in my mind, and his use of the harp guitar and other instruments and things like that. But so I decided we'll have to play a bit of Michael Hedges. Now, when David was on the phone last night, he talked about when he saw Michael Hedges, and Michael Hedges actually did a cover of a Madonna song. And one of the things that he did brilliantly, aside from his own slightly atmospheric instrumental music, one of his tracks is called Breakfast in the Field, and I'm telling you, you put headphones on and listen to that guitar piece, and it feels like you're having breakfast in a field. Just an amazing player. But he did great covers. And I, unfortunately, at the moment, don't have the live version of this cover, but I have the studio version. And Hedges, one of my favorite of his live covers was him doing Dylan's All Along the Watchtower. And a thing to keep in mind here, this is not harp guitar. This is just a six-string Martin, I believe, about a 1910 Martin. But to get a little bit more of that bottom end thing happening, the sixth string, you know, the big fat E string, nah, that bronze thing's just not going to do. We're going to put the G string from a bass guitar on on the Martin, on the antique Martin. And as David from Maine popping in the chat room right now says, Hedges had an awesome voice too, and that was the thing, absolutely angelic and effortless. That was the thing that used to just blow me away. This guy, you know, playing this physical style of guitar, dancing barefoot with sticks of incense in the headstock of the guitar, and yet this effortless angelic voice would come out. And as you listen to this, remember, this is one guy, one guitar, one take. No edits, no overdubs. That's it. So there's a vocal microphone and a stereo mic set up on the acoustic, and that's it. So I like this version even more than Hendrix's version of Dylan's All Along the Watchtower. So without further ado, roll it, Mr. Michael Hedges. Go, Bob.
Be some kind of way out of here, said the joker to the thief. Too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it's worth. No reason to get excited, the thief he kindly spoke. There are many here among us who think that life is but a joke. But you and I, we've been through all that, and this is not our fate. So let us not talk falsely now, the hour is getting late. We'll be right back. senses kept the view. While all the women came and went, barefoot servants too. Outside in the distance, a wild cat did growl. Two riders were approaching, and the wind began to howl.
That is just outstanding, and I wish I had the live version handy. I know I've got it around somewhere because it's a little bit more aggressive, and one of the best covers that he did was Come Together. And yes, he and David knows. He told some of the best stories. He was a great storyteller, and because he played in so many odd and unusual tunings and usually didn't change guitars in his shows, he'd tell these stories as he'd be retuning, and it would be this really relaxed thing, and he just had amazing comical timing, a beautiful kind of energy that he put across. I've never quite seen anyone quite like him. And the one time that I did get to see him, he was opening up for Crosby, Stills, and Nash at the Sunken Gardens Theater in San Antonio, Texas. And I was probably one of only maybe a couple of hundred people in the 6,000 in that audience that actually knew who Hedges was. And, I mean, we had trouble parking, and I'm like dragging people. They're going, oh, you know, it's only the opening act. And I'm saying, no. This is just, you got to get down here. We got hurry. If I miss a note of the man, I'm going to hurt you all. And he comes out, and he's barefoot in bell bottoms with a headset microphone, and absolutely stuns the audience. And towards the end of the show, he actually jumps off the stage down onto the concrete dance floor. And the crowd just opened up for him, and he played one of his instrumentals while just dancing like a madman on the floor. And I think that night I saw one of the greatest musician-to-musician compliments I've ever seen in my entire life. Crosby, Stills, and Nash start their show. I'll never forget this. And I can't remember what song they started with, but one by one they entered playing, and it started off with Graham at the piano, I believe, and one by one they come out and join in, and just as the downbeat of the first chorus is about to kick in and the band is all going to join them, they stop dead, and they all look at the audience, and they said, what did you think of Michael? And the audience just kind of, you hear this collective kind of like, ah, oh. And they said, yeah, we ran into him on the road once, and were just blown away. And we approached him and said, "You have to come on tour with us. The country needs to know who you are." And it was the first time he'd ever played in Texas. And I was working for Alamo Music Store at the time, and Michael was endorsing Takamine guitars, and he was only doing it for some extra money. He never, ever played a Takamine anywhere. He, you know, did a few photographs for ads, and that was about it. He played, you know, antique Martins and things like that. You know, he wouldn't dare play some, you know, Korean, production guitar that just, you know, would never have done. But anyway, the rep for Takamine, of course, went to go meet him and get a couple of guitars signed, and this rep was one of these, you know, book-learned guitar players. You know, he was a fine player, no feel, no offense, mate, but, and he just thought he was the bee's knees. And I was telling him, I said, look, man, if you're not familiar with this guy, you seriously are going to be blown away. and he said that he's never seen anyone quite like Michael either. And when Michael came off the stage, he said, I swear, it appeared as though his feet were about 3 feet off the ground, and he floated off stage and just said, I think I've made a few friends today. And I said, that's him. That's just him. And, you know, David's got some great comments in the chat room. You know, here, I'll just give you a couple of them. Hedges was the one who gave Wyndham Hill, which was the label that he was on, a distinct edge in terms of presentation. He had a lot of yogis come out to his shows. I think afterwards musicians and artists started taking Wyndham Hill in a more serious light than just background music. And I have to agree with you there. There were some really good players on Wyndham Hill as a label, but none of them had quite the dynamic playing or the personality or the appreciation for the enjoyment for the audience. And if you search Michael Hedges on YouTube, there's some great live clips that people have that they've bootlegged and things. I believe the website for Hedges is nomadland.com, and you can see stuff about him there. And unfortunately, back, I think it was in about 1998 or something like that, he fell asleep at the wheel coming home from a gig and crashed his car, and he was gone. You know, it seriously was a loss, but he's influenced a huge amount of players. He brought the harp guitar back into... He brought the harp guitar back into the forefront, you know. There really aren't words to quite describe him. So if you have a chance, go check out YouTube and just search Michael Hedges. And I suggest there are clips of Breakfast in the Field. I can't think of the name of the one track, but it's known as Death by Guitar, by guitar players. But any of it. And there is a live clip of him doing Come Together, where he, towards the end, has this very comical way of bringing the entire audience in to create the whole Beatles arrangement. And it's hysterical. It's just really, really good. But anyway, Michael Hedges, genius without peer, and sung like a bird. There's a track that I'll play one day, called "Woman of the World," which I think is one of the most beautiful songs ever written, hands down. It's just absolutely phenomenal. It's just a beautiful piece of work, a beautiful melody, and the guitar part is genius. And up until an album called Taproot, virtually everything was recorded straight to two-track, and there were some tracks where he had, was it Michael Manring playing bass? He would have this fretless bass player, but the two instruments kind of got flipped on their head in their roles. The fretless bass became the lead and melody instrument in many ways, and always kind of throwing tradition to the wind, and just beautiful, beautiful stuff. Manring, just incredible! What a player! And again, when he did these things with Manring, it was all direct to two-track. There was never any mixing involved. In fact, the reverbs were even printed directly to tape. How it was done was how it was heard. And that just shows incredible prowess and a love for the organic. Anyway, I tell you what, Bob, why don't we take a quick break? I'm going to get some things together, and we're going to get into some real subject matter. So you listen to Foxed Up here on the Head On Radio Network, folks. We will be right back and talk about the global oil quandary. Stick around.
In your manual, you taught us how to hold it. You gotta hold it in this manner to play them fancy licks. Now we're happily strumming along, and you ought to hear us play. And I guess we owe it all to you. Thanks a lot, Mel Bay. Mel Bay, Mel Bay. We just want to say we wouldn't know what we're doing if you had shown the way. Mel Bay, Mel Bay. Every time we play, we always think of you, and I hope you'll have a nice day. Take it!
You're listening to the Head On Radio Network.
Mel Bay.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Everybody comes to Rick's.
If he can stand it, I can. Play it.
Howdy, Rangers. Tune into Rick's Place. You'll be fascinated with porn psychotherapist Rick Goodner's take on all of today's political issues from a real Texan's liberal point of view. So mosey on into Rick's Place for some good old hospitality with Rick Goodner. See you there, Rangers, this Saturday right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
And if you want another kind of love, I wear a mask for you. If you want a partner, open my hand. If you want to strike me down in anger, here I stand. If I'm your man.
Don't miss Rick's Place with Rick Goodner, part of the weekend lineup on The Horn, running all weekend in rotation with The Showers Report and Night Sounds.
I was dipping to the rain.
If you or someone close to you has a hearing loss, here is some great news. Thousands of Open Caption videos are yours to borrow, and it's all free. Open Caption videos make it possible for the hearing impaired to understand television. The Caption Media Program offers classic Hollywood movies, special interests, and educational videos. Visit us online at cfv.org or call 1-800-237-6213. You can register to be a user and make your selections from our online or printed catalog. It's just that easy, and we'll even pay for the postage. Open Caption videos are perfect for the classroom, your home, or even the workplace. The nonprofit Caption Media Program is funded by the U.S. Department of Education and administered by the National Association of the Deaf. Tell a family member or a friend about the Caption Media Program today. Bookmark cfv.org for free loan Open Caption videos or call
1-800-237-6213. Alrighty then, welcome back to Foxed Up here on the Head On Radio Network. Okay, I love that Mel Bay song. It's just a riot. Chet Atkins and Tommy Emmanuel. And that really, really bad guitar solo is actually straight out of the Mel Bay Guitar One book. It's a musical joke song, but anyway. Actually, the entire arrangement comes out of the Mel Bay guitar, drum, and bass and mandolin book one. It's from their album When Finger Pickers Take Over the World, which is just fantastic. It's an incredible record. Very, very lighthearted, very, very much fun. And Tommy Emmanuel, what a genius. I still never forget when I was kind of first in the country and I was, you know, doing smaller gigs and things, and I was working out at a lighting factory, and the guy who was the floor manager for this lighting factory, his brother was the drummer in a band called Dragon. And Dragon is the band that Tommy Emmanuel started in. They were fairly big down here in Australia for a while. And people used to ask his brother, you know, so what did you think of Tommy Emmanuel as a guitar player? And his response is always, best two damn guitar players I ever heard in my life. Because when Tommy left the band, they had to replace him with two people. And that's a fact. But anyway, let's get into the subject for tonight. We got all this talk about biofuels. And I even signed on to the biofuel concept early on. And as a whole, it's not a bad idea, but where we source it from is of serious concern. And we're starting to see some of the problems with using crops to develop biofuels. There are other ways to do it. There are ways that you can make biofuels out of virtually anything, and out of food waste would be better. You can even make it out of old tires. But we're running into a problem now with this concept of corn and other grains being used, because we're ending up with a situation of not only competition for growing space between food and fuel, but we're also running out of just general agriculture space due to building and development, and also due to global warming, because the good growing areas are beginning to disappear, unfortunately, and it's a tough thing. So there's this great piece. Bob sent this to me the other day, and it's from the New York Times in the World Business section. And the title of it is A New Global Oil Quandary: Costly Fuel Means Costly Calories. And I'm going to read you a few bits from this because I think it lays out the problem. And, you know, as we try and make a transition from oil-based fuel sources, we can't be creating a whole new problem. So this piece comes out of Malaysia, and he opens saying, rising prices for cooking oil are forcing residents of Asia's largest slum in Mumbai, India, to ration every drop. Bakeries in the United States are fretting over higher shortening costs. And here in Malaysia, brand new factories built to convert vegetable oil into diesel sit idle, their owners unable to afford the raw material. This is the other oil shock. From India to Indiana, shortages are soaring. Prices for palm oil, soybean oil, and other types of vegetable oils are the latest, most striking example of a developing global problem: costly food. The Food Price Index of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, based on export prices for 60 internationally traded foodstuffs, climbed 37% last year. That was on top of a 14% increase in 2006, and the trend has accelerated this winter. In some poor countries, desperation is taking hold. Just in the last week, protests have erupted in Pakistan over wheat shortages and in Indonesia over soybean shortages. Egypt has banned rice exports to keep food at home, and China has put controls on cooking oil, grain, meat, milk, and eggs. According to the FAO, food riots have erupted in recent months in Guinea, Mexico, Morocco, Senegal, Uzbekistan, and Yemen. The urban poor and the rural landless and this is crucial, rural, landless, and small marginal farmers stand to lose. A startling change is unfolding in the world's food markets. Soaring fuel prices have altered the equation for growing food and transportation and transporting across the globe. Huge demand for biofuels has created tension between using land to produce fuel and using it for food. So we're dealing with issues that are twofold here. Not only are we running into an issue that our mechanized farming systems are running into problems because of the cost of fuel. We're now running into a second issue where, trying to compensate for the oil problem, we're now making crops compete between fuel and food. And as we talked about on the Horn section last night, the corn you grow for ethanol can't be used for human consumption. This creates a real problem. And you look at a country like Australia that has been, up until this year, and still in many parts is, in extreme drought, we're running into rising food costs because of the environment already. So this becomes a real compounding problem. What they say here a startling change is unfolding in the world's food markets. Soaring fuel prices have altered the equation for growing food and, as they say, transporting across the globe. A growing middle class in the developing world is demanding more protein, from pork and hamburgers to chicken and ice cream. And all this is happening even as global climate change may be starting to make it harder to grow food in some places best equipped to do so, and they use Australia as an example. In the last few years, world demand for crops and meat has been rising sharply. It remains an open question how and when the supply will catch up. For the foreseeable future, that probably means higher prices at the grocery store and fatter paychecks for farmers and major crops like corn, wheat, and soybeans. And so, you know, ethanol may not be the be-all, end-all. And it's, as the CEO of General Motors said a couple of weeks ago, that ethanol maybe should only be looked at as a short-term solution until their systems, as they're looking to do, to create biofuels from waste material, which I think is much more viable. If we can take things that are causing other problems, like, you know, landfill capacity problems, and landfills are huge, are huge sources of excess methane, which, even though it's not as, there's not as much of it in the atmosphere per molecule, it is actually more damaging than carbon when it comes to the issue of the warming of the globe. Now, this is I think that this piece, and there's a link to it on today's show post, really, really gets to the nitty-gritty of this and looks at it from a whole bunch of different areas. He continues on where he says, no category of food prices has risen as quickly this winter as the so-called edible oils, with sometimes tragic results. When a Carrefour store in Chongqing, China, announced a limited-time cooking oil promotion in November, a stampede of would-be buyers left 3 people dead and 31 injured. So, I mean, this is not just about, you know, it's going to get a little bit more expensive. we're going to end up having people fighting one another for these basic foodstuffs. So I think there is reason for pause, and the European Union is looking at their original biofuel conversion targets and rethinking them because of this data that's coming in, and the chat room is trying really hard to distract me. Ha 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 ha. I'm not paying attention, you lot. I'm trying to be serious here. It says here, cooking oil may seem like a trifling expense in the West, but in the developing world, cooking oil is an important source of calories and represents one of the biggest cash outlays for poor families, which grow much of their own food, but have to buy oil in which to cook it. Few crops illustrate the emerging problems in the global food chain as well as palm oil, a vital commodity to much of the world and particularly Asia. From jungles and street markets in Southeast Asia to food companies in the United States, the biodiesel factories in Europe, soaring prices for the oil are drawing environmentalists, energy companies, consumers, indigenous peoples, and governments into acrimonious disputes. Another factor that has come into this is with the whole kind of turning against trans fats because of the health issues. This has also added an increased demand on things like palm oil and other vegetable oils and other food oils. And again, it's just step by step by step by step, we look like we could be creating a whole nother problem. And they talk about how palm oil is a very efficient crop. The palm is a highly efficient producer of vegetable oil. Squeezed from the tree's thick bunches of plum-sized bright red fruit, an acre of oil palms yields as much oil as 8 acres of soybeans, the main rival for oil palms. Rapeseed used to make canola oil and is a distant third among major crops. Only sugarcane comes close to rivaling oil palms in calories of human food per acre. Palm oil prices have jumped nearly 70% in the last year because supply has grown slowly while demand has soared. And this is this is something we have to be very careful of. And, you know, areas like Iowa in the United States where huge, huge amounts of the corn production have been turned to ethanol because of the higher price that ethanol corn can draw, it again is pulling away from the foodstuffs. It's not mentioned in this article, but in the past year, Mexicans have had to go without the staple of their diet, which is corn tortillas, because they haven't been able to get the corn. And it's been very much attributed to the use of corn for fuel. And this is really unfortunate because anything that could get us off the oil standard, I'm in great favor of. But again, we cannot be short-sighted about these things. Continues, farmers and plantation companies are responding to the higher prices, clearing hundreds of thousands of acres of tropical forest to replant with rows of oil palms. But an oil palm takes 8 years to reach full production. A drought last year in Indonesia and flooding in the peninsular Malaysia helped constrain supply. Worldwide palm oil output climbed just 2.7% last year to 42.1 million tons. At the same time, palm oil demand is growing steeply for a variety of reasons around the globe. They include shifting decisions among farmers about what to plant, rising consumer demand in China and India for edible oils, and Western subsidies for biofuel productions. And one of the other problems that's happening with some countries are beginning to subsidize these food oils to try and help their populations. But then what happens? You have bootleggers that go and hoard palm oils and other oils from countries that are subsidizing it, and then taking it and selling it in countries that are not subsidizing it. So it's creating a black market for food oil. And this is one of these situations where, you know, you really wonder where our priorities are on this planet. Do we really, really care if people live or die? And this really is a live or die situation. They say here also that Chinese farmers also cut back soybean acreage last year as urban sprawl covered prime farmland, and the Chinese government provided more incentives for grain because they're now gaining more Western diets. They're wanting more wheat and things. Yet people in China are also consuming more oils. China not only was the world's biggest palm oil importer last year, holding a steady 5.2 million tons in the first 11 months of the year, but it also doubled its soybean oil imports to 2.9 million tons, forcing buyers elsewhere to switch to palm oil. Concerns about nutrition used to hurt palm oil sales, but they are now starting to help. The oil was long regarded in the West as unhealthy, but it has become an attractive option to replace the chemically altered fats known as trans fats, which have lately come to be seen as the least healthy of all fats. They talk about New York City banned trans fats in frying at food service establishments last summer and will ban them in bakery goods this summer. Across the country, manufacturers are trying to replace trans fats. American palm oil imports nearly doubled in the first 11 months of last year, rising by 200,000 tons. 4 years ago, when the whole no trans issue started, we processed no palms here, said Mark Wayland, a United States product manager for Loders Crockland, a Dutch company which supplies palm oil. Now it's our biggest seller. Last year, conversion of palm oil into fuel was a fast-growing source of demand, but in recent weeks, rising prices have thrown that business into turmoil. And what is going to be the run-on effect of clearing ancient rainforest to plant these crops to make up the demand? I fear that we're setting up a whole nother problem. And what are we gonna do about it? That's the big question. I think we have to rethink where we source biofuels from, and that they really can't come from virgin crop. They need to come from waste material, which I think where General Motors and their partnership with this biofuel outfit are on the right track, where they can take waste material, food waste, food scraps, and actually turn it, and their plan is to actually turn it into biofuel for less than $1 a gallon. So if we're going to actually take a waste product, it's a win-win, because we're producing fuel that we need without competing against food crops, and also dealing with another global warming issue, which is methane from rotting food. It's a big problem. You know, the right wingers like to talk about cow farts. It's not cow farts that are producing the methane. It's our waste material, not cow farts. And with countries like China now having their diet changed so much, where they're starting to eat a lot more, you know, beef and chicken and things like that, that puts even more strain on grain crops. Because as everyone knows, it takes a whole lot of grain to fully develop a cow. And you don't get the caloric return that you would from the grain itself. So, you know, like I've said before, if you can cut one beef meal out of your week, do it. You're actually doing more than just your cholesterol count good. you'll actually be reducing demand on grazing land. I mean, you know, McDonald's bloody clears countless acreage of rainforest just to grow, just to graze hamburger for cheap, crappy burgers. You know, Nanette's mentioning here about Union Carbide, a trash-to-gas program in South Charleston. These are real options. I've mentioned before, there's this guy up in northern New South Wales that built a methane to electricity conversion system for his small community. And they now are able to not only power the entire small community, but they're feeding back into the grid. But then you have the insanity of protectionist legislation that if he generates one more kilowatt than he is already, he's going to have to pay penalties to the coal industry for taking their profits. David, you're just trying to, you're really trying to get me in the chat room, aren't you? I'm not. Yes, I said methane. Geez, you know, it gets late and everybody just starts to lose the plot. I try to be serious and y'all just won't ride along, but hey. You're not going to make me lose it. Just to kind of get towards the end of this piece here a little bit. They talk about demand outstripping supply. As the multiple conflicts and economic pressures associated with palm oil play out in the local economy, the bottom line seems to be that the world wants more of the oil than it can get. Seems like we have this problem with a lot of things. Even in Malaysia, the center of the global palm oil industry for half a century, spot shortages have cropped up. Recently, as wholesale prices soared, cooking oil refiners complained inadequate subsidies and cut back production of household oil sold at low regulated prices. Street vendors in the capital, Kuala Lumpur, complain that they cannot find enough cooking oil to prepare roti canai, the flatbread that is the national snack. It's very difficult, it's hard to find, said one vendor who gave only his first name, Polini, after admitting that he was secretly buying cooking oil intended for households instead of paying the much higher price for commercial use. Many of the hardest hit victims of rising food prices are in the vast slums of the surrounding cities in poorer Asian nations. The Kowali family in Mumbai sprawling Dharavi slum, a household of nine with just one member working as a laborer for $60 a month, is coping with recent price increases for palm oil. The family has responded by eating fish once a week instead of twice, seldom cooking vegetables, and cutting its monthly rice consumption. Next to go will be the weekly smidgen of lamb. If the prices go up again, said Janarin, the family patriarch, we will cut the mutton to twice a month and use less oil. This is, you know, I know that we need to take serious action when it comes to our global warming issues and our fuel problems. And that I'm all in favor of that, but we have to be very careful that we don't create a whole new problem. And what bugs me is the fact that the one problem that I have with biofuels is it still creates a financial infrastructure that wants to keep you connected to a gas pump. And the profit motive will outstrip the social need. And I'm not sure exactly how we combat that. And as the climate shifts further and traditional agriculture lands become unusable, it's only going to accelerate this problem. I think this is something that needs to be reassessed in a big way. In a big way. I am much more... I'm hoping that GM and their moves to create a consistent supply of biofuels with waste material will, turn out to be what they're hoping it's going to be. Because I think it's the way that it's going to have to be, or else we're just going to set up a whole other problem. And clearing of tropical rainforest to grow crops is a horrible idea. The rainforests are one of the best carbon sinks that we've got, second only to the world's oceans. So we need to be... we need to be very careful with what we do. folks, if you're not in the chat room, you should be in there. They're having a ball in there, and David's just being a right royal... we're talking about launching cows from catapults from Monty Python. I'm sorry, that is a very funny image that comes into my mind. I don't want to get rid of the cows. I just don't want to be knocking down rainforests to give them more grazing land. Because, hey, I still like a good burger once in a while. I really like a good steak even. But, all of this is going to create, and I mean, they've been talking about this in Australia for a while here, fresh food prices have skyrocketed over the last year. And they reckon that it's only the beginning. Yeah, Bob, I think you've nailed it right there. It's all about learning the meaning of carrying capacity again. You're absolutely right. And, the mechanized farming industry is a huge problem. Because if the threats of peak oil, as we know, really hit hard, and suddenly there are real fuel shortages, and we haven't come up with an alternative, the world will starve. The world will starve. Because most of the world, well, most of the Western world, doesn't know how to grow their own bloody food anymore. They depend on having it brought to them so that they can go down to a local grocery store and have everything they want. And it's just, it's, again, one of these things. It's not sustainable. Carrying capacity. That's very, very good, Very, 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 very good. Anyway, I think I'm going to wrap it up because it's chaos in the chat room. And it's been one of those technical days. My brain has been struggling very, very hard today to keep it together. But, hey, we made it to the end. And before we go, I'd like to thank Bob for producing. Thanks to Ben Birch at the White Rose Society for everything that he does. Thanks to Scott Berry at B1 Ladder Productions for the music. Thank you to the mods and our bloggers for everything that they do for us. And thanks to you for spending the night with us. And as we say here on Foxed Up, be good, be green. We'll see you tomorrow.
Rolling. If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, I would tell you that sometimes it's easier to desire and pursue the attention and admiration of 100 strangers than it is to accept the love and loyalty of those closest to me. And I would tell you that sometimes I prefer to look at myself through someone else's eyes eyes that aren't clouded with the tears of knowing what an asshole I can be, as yours are. If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, I might be able to listen in silence to your concerns, rather than hearing everything as an accusation or an indictment against me. And I would tell you that sometimes I use sex to avoid communication. It's the best escape when we're down on our luck. But I can express more emotions than laughter, anger, and let's f***. If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, if ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, if ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, if ever I would stop thinking about music and politics.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I think the nation is just starting to settle down after Super Tuesday and finally start to look at some other things going on. We're going to talk both about Super Tuesday and the other things going on. So if you want to call in on any issue, it's like the Week in Review. Please, please feel free to call in. But America voted, 22 states, that is, voted, and it came down, at least in the Democratic race, to a big tie. And I don't know, part of me found that kind of amusing. I sort of thought of myself, I guess, as the stereotypical Democrat, and lo and behold, I am, in the sense that I had a really hard time deciding between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And even though I've endorsed Obama, I must be clear, this is not a head-on, throaty, you've got to vote for Obama or this country's in real trouble endorsement. It just isn't. I would be very happy with Hillary Clinton as my president. I'd be very happy if it were a Clinton-Obama ticket. I still slightly prefer Obama because I think he will do better in the fall. But if you want to vote for Hillary Clinton, I'm not going to knock you. I don't blame you. I just want us all to work together in November. But so we went and we go state by state by state, and really it's amazing. At the end of all this, you look at the delegate count, and they're, what, four delegates apart? I mean, they're still counting in New Mexico, 838, 834. It hardly matters. The Democrats came down to a tie, and I think they understand the benefits of both of our candidates, the vision of Barack Obama, the practicality of Hillary Clinton, the details of Hillary Clinton, the inspiration of Barack Obama. There's just a lot to be said for both of them. And my only hope, my main hope at this point, is despite the fact that while a political junkie that I am, I love the idea of a close race. Just like, heck, you know, sports-minded people love a close basketball or football game because it's exciting and you're not sure who's going to win. I get that. I understand that. I share in that. Part of me is relishing the fact that this race is so close and may go to the convention. But the practical person in me fears it. Again, if I've endorsed Barack Obama, I would be very, very happy if he were to win. But I would also be very happy if Hillary Clinton were to win. My concern, though, is that as they fight to the finish, if it's too close, I don't want it to tear our party apart. So let's keep this in mind over the next 6 months. I think it is going to the convention. I don't think either candidate will concede at this point. They're way too close. We'll just have to see who wins. But whoever wins, I really beg all of you to give him or her or him, your full-throated support. We need that. And frankly, I'm worried. A friend of mine who shares many of my political beliefs said today that he felt that John McCain was going to win in November 2008. And I shuddered. And it's not that John McCain would dig us too much deeper than George Bush has dug us. I grant you that. George Bush has dug a bigger hole for the American people than really anybody could. I mean, when you think about it, if a trained monkey had been president, or a small child, or maybe a turtle, they could never have done the damage to this nation that George Bush has done. I mean, merely having no one as president would have been a far, far more more prosperous America than having George Bush as president, right? If he just simply left tax rates alone and not transferred money from the poor to the rich, if he simply left the peace alone and not done a preemptive war against a country that never attacked us, we would have 4,000 more living American servicemen and women, 30,000 less wounded. Iraq would be, oh, still under the grip of Saddam Hussein, but far better off with more electricity and jobs and benefits than it has now. That doesn't mean it was great under Saddam Hussein. It just would have been better under that than it is now. The world will not hate us as much as it does. George Bush, again, if you put a monkey there, I think there's no question the monkey would have done a better job. Now, John McCain, I think, is not as bad as George Bush. I'll say that right here on the air. But he would not dig us out of the hole. He would dig us a little deeper. Maybe not as quickly and as deeply as George Bush.